Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and today we are going to continue. I mean, this is the new year, this is 2024, but the war that we've been covering, the war in Palestine, the genocide being waged on Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli apartheid army and its US backers continues, and so therefore we will continue to cover it here on Back in the USSR. The death toll is now at least 24,000 in Gaza. At least 10,000 of those are kids. And, you know, we don't know. There's at least 8,000 people who are missing right now, presumably trapped under the rubble and are most likely dead, which pushes the death toll to well above 30,000. And there is no sign of any end in sight. I mean, this is the resistance continues. I mean, there is strong resistance to the Israeli incursions. You know, the Israelis are taking losses. They're being very tight-lipped on what losses they take, understandably, but they're fighting on multiple fronts now. And of course, the wider Middle East is now increasing. It looks like there's a wider war going on, with the U.S. having just conducted airstrikes massive airstrikes on Yemen, where the Ansar Allah movement has, in solidarity with Gaza and solidarity with Palestine, has been stopping ships passing through the Red Sea going to Israel. Now, and of course, you know, solidarity with that kind of solidarity with Palestine is not tolerated by the U.S., which is Israel's strongest backer, and they're now intervening to effectively facilitate the ongoing genocide, you know, and try to keep those sea lanes open so that Israel gets what it needs to continue the genocide on Palestinians. Like, that's how messed up morally we're talking here. But the solidarity with Palestine is worldwide and growing all the time, and we had tens of thousands of people in all over North America, Washington, D.C., immense demonstration there on Saturday. You know, there was demonstration in Guelph, even was relatively small, it was very vocal. In Toronto, basically almost every major city, we're talking like huge solidarity, expressions of solidarity with the Palestinian people. And of course, worldwide, you know, like in the global south and most countries in the world are standing with Palestine right now. And we see that solidarity in the case which is being brought against Israel at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in The Hague. That was brought by South Africa. South Africa, of course, a country which had, you know, very intimate experience with apartheid and resisting apartheid and ultimately overthrowing apartheid, and is now bringing a case against an apartheid state, Israel, which is waging genocide against the Palestinians. And, you know, they're trying to get some, you know, this is a very powerful, perhaps symbolic, but very powerful act of solidarity, which is going on now, and which really has Israel scrambling and Israel's allies scrambling to try to get to grips with this. So I'm going to, just for the details in the case, I'm going to play a clip of Vijay Prashad. You know, amazing commentator, writer, journalist, who kind of unpacked this whole court case and its significance on Give the People What They Want podcast on January 12th. So I'm going to play that right now. He really breaks it down in a very effective way. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch. There's Prashant and Zoe. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. It's the 156th episode. We're knee-deep in January. Just off the very interesting debate that took place at the International Court of Justice at The Hague. It's very important to understand that the International Court of Justice is an arbitration place, a dispute settlement court between states. So if a state has a problem with another state around an international treaty, the state can actually appeal to the International Court of Justice for arbitration. This is different from the International Criminal Court, where there's a special prosecutor appointed by the court to essentially indict individuals on the basis of the Rome Statute, a treaty signed by countries that are parties to the International Criminal Court. That's a separate body which actually indicts individuals. The International Court of Justice is where one state can complain about the behavior of another state, which is why on January 10th, South Africa, which actually opened the dispute with Israel in the International Court of Justice, presented its case first, and the South African jurist, helped by an important lawyer from Ireland, made a very strong case at the court. Adela Hashim, South African lawyer, told the judges something that I'd like to share with you. She said, genocides are never declared in advance, but this court, she says, the International Court of Justice, has the benefit of the past 13 weeks of evidence that shows incontrovertibly a pattern of conduct and related intention that justifies as a plausible claim of genocide acts. Now, This is very important language as a plausible claim of genocide acts. Why do we need to emphasize that? Because this hearing is a prima facie hearing. This hearing is not a trial about Israel's behavior. This is merely a hearing for the 15-member judge panel to agree to accept the case that has been brought to them by South Africa and then to open a trial at some later date. So that's why it's very important to take seriously what the lawyers are arguing about. They are trying to say there is a case here of genocide to be brought against the Israeli state. And that's what South Africa put on the table on the 11th of January. Very strong arguments. They put all the facts out there. In fact, the 84-page complaint against Israel, which was circulated prior to this hearing, is itself a very strong indictment of Israel. There's an entire section, which I think is extremely important, where they basically take the statements made by high Israeli officials and demonstrate that these statements have genocidal intent. In other words, not only do you have genocidal action, wiping out of families, you know, now close to 400 families have lost over 10 members per family. So, you know, that itself shows a genocidal act, wiping out people, pushing them out of Gaza and so on. But the statements made by high officials prior to the violence, in other words, from October 8th onward, were itself genocidal, including using phrases like the second Nakba, Nakba being catastrophe, the Arabic word for catastrophe, the second Nakba or the Gaza Nakba, or calling the people of Gaza human animals. That language is all documented by the South Africans in the indictment, in the complaint that they put before the judges at the ICJ. And basically, on the 11th of January, that's precisely what the four principal jurists, the four principal lawyers, that's the case they made before the court. Now, on the 12th of January, the Israelis responded to the complaint. A very interesting avenue they took. But before I tell you what exactly the Israelis said, it is important to bear in mind that after day one of the hearing, when the South Africans made their case, the United States government did not comment. They were asked repeatedly to comment on the South African claim. They didn't comment at all. I think this is important. We're going to get back to this in a minute because they commented in another way with a different language. Interesting case made by the Israelis in defense against the South African complaint. What the Israelis said effectively is, yes, 23,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. That is, as to use the words of Adil Hashim, that is incontrovertible evidence. Of course, 23,000 people have been killed. But, and unsurprisingly, just as Israel has been saying from the 7th of October, the author of those killings, they argue, is not the Israeli state, but Hamas. Even though they acknowledge that it's Israeli bombs and firearms that have actually taken the lives of the Palestinians, they say that responsibility for the killings is not with the Israelis, but with the Palestinians. That has been the sum total of the Israeli case against the accusation from South Africa. But what happens next is that the 15-judge panel will consider this, and they will basically figure out whether they want to take the trial forward. I must say, they can also put out there a provisional finding that essentially asks the country that is being accused of genocide to stop its actions. In other words, if the prima facie evidence is incontrovertible, using their language again, if it's incontrovertible, the court can actually intervene to put out a finding, an immediate preliminary finding saying stop the violence against the people. This is interesting. It's widely anticipated this may not happen because of the constitution of the jurists on the court. The president of the of the 15 jury of the 15 judge panel is a U.S. judge. It's very unlikely that they're going to immediately put out such a finding. But the pressure on that court is very, very high. They are experiencing a lot of pressure from around the world. Number of countries signed up to join South Africa. It's important to say, just for the record, South Africa is not a Muslim majority country. In fact, the Muslim population is quite small, negligible in South Africa. There is a Palestinian population, negligible. They have taken this case to the International Court of Justice. In the words of Naledi Pandor, the head of international relations, or foreign minister, they have taken this case because of their special history with apartheid, because of their special understanding of apartheid and genocidal acts by the apartheid regime against the people of South Africa. Now, I mentioned earlier that the United States wouldn't comment, Prashant. They wouldn't comment about day one of the proceedings. I doubt that they'll comment on day two either. But they commented in a different way, didn't they?
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Vijay Prashad outlining the case brought by South Africa against Israel in the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Now, I want to move on and talk about just one of the many crimes outlined in this case, many war crimes, blatant war crimes that Israel has committed, and that, of course, is attacks on journalists. I believe the current number of slain Palestinian journalists amounts to about 117, and I've heard that that is actually worse than World War II. I mean, Justin Podor, I believe in one of his recent podcasts, discuss that being as worse than World War II in terms of the numbers of journalists targeted for assassination, journalists killed in cold blood, journalists actually tracked down, killed alongside their families. That is the kind of thing that's been going on in Gaza and the West Bank against Palestinians who have tried to cover, the bloodshed and and tried to document what is really going on. They have found themselves in the crosshairs. And that is the subject of this next clip I want to play, which is Anand Kumar, who is interviewed on Breakthrough News. He was interviewed, I believe, on the 13th of January, who is a Palestinian journalist himself, and who discusses this with Rania Khalik on Breakthrough News. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that for you now.
Well, we have another guest on the line, also stayed up late for us. So I have to say we're very honored to have coming to us from the occupied West Bank as we turn our attention back to Palestine. We are really, really honored to have with us Anand Kumar, who's a volunteer with the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate. Anand, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. I think some people or almost everyone have seen that journalists have been increasingly significantly targeted in Palestine in the post-October 7th era. So, as we started, I was hoping you could just say something about what the impact and the toll has been on Palestinian journalists during this conflict.
It has been devastating. We have seen nothing like this before, and I think the world has never seen anything like this before. Over the last 3 months, the Israeli military campaign has carried out a calculated assassination campaign against our journalists. They were targeted and killed one by one, almost on a rate of one per day. Up to a few days ago, it was the total was 109. Our investigations show that out of the 109, there is at least 96 who were specifically targeted, including 22 in the line of duty, and the rest were targeted in strikes that specifically hit their houses and killed them, sometimes many times along with their family members. Many journalists also have had threats, and following these threats, their family members were targeted and attacked and killed. We have injured journalists who are in needing of urgent medical care that is not available to them at the moment in Gaza because Israel destroyed the health system, and they are not allowed to seek the needed healthcare outside the borders of Gaza because of Israel's blockade. So it has been totally devastating. In quest of our journalists who are still continuing to work, they are having to make unimaginable choices and decisions every day while they are rightly recognized as a potential target for Israeli attacks at any moment, including choosing basically who to kill alongside you or to be killed alongside, really, what house to stay in and so on. So it's no different to what Palestinians are experiencing under this Israeli military campaign. And one thing that stands out for our journalists is that they're working hard, as hard as you can, and putting their lives on the line in order to bring an end to this.
You know, you're talking to us from the West Bank, and obviously the scale of destruction and of targeted killings in Gaza is so much higher than what we're seeing in the West Bank. And as a result, what's happening in the West Bank has gotten far less attention. But it's nonetheless, it's quite horrific what we're seeing in the West Bank as well. Could you talk a bit about what the Israeli occupying forces have been doing in the West Bank over the last couple of months in terms of targeting certain towns and cities quite aggressively in what looks like war? I mean, it looks like war, what we're seeing in the West Bank, as well as, you know, I know they've been targeting certain kinds of infrastructure. I imagine, though I'm not sure, but I imagine they've also been targeting media as well. But can you talk a bit about what's taking place in the West Bank?
Yes. What has been happening in the West Bank has started long ago, well before the last 3 months. I live in Tulkarem. I was waiting patiently for my turn to come on because I don't know how long the electricity will stay with us because I live next to Tulkarem refugee camp, and my brother just walked in and said that the army is in the city. So this is the start of another incursion. These incursions were regular and frequent before October 7th and have become more regular, but have become a lot more aggressive. There is clearly a softening, as the Israeli media calls it, of rules of engagement, which allows the Israeli army to carry out practices exactly like you're showing in the on the screen, of collective punishment, where the bulldozers just drive into refugee camps, paving way, destroying people's homes and shops. And one of the most consistent patterns in the city of Tulkarem, where I live now, is the destruction to infrastructure, particularly water and electricity, which is a form of collective punishment. This is their way of cutting water and electricity from the local population in the areas where they are operating. But not only this, we see signs of almost military practice in these cities, where they come in, they practice withholding a whole city under curfew for extended periods of time that are getting longer and longer, totally aimlessly and pointlessly. They control certain areas where the soldiers will go from house to house, get all the men out, carry out what they call field investigations or interrogations, mostly using violence. Most of those who are interrogated are released soon after in the same local area where they're picked up from their homes, and money will be transferred out of the city, only to be released right at the border, at the crossing. In the last two incursions, vast majority of all who were arrested, like I said, were released either in the same moment or like within hours, or were taken to different locations in the West Bank. Last time it was the crossing west of Tulkarem, the one before that in Hawara, Both times, those who were released had severe injuries as a result of interrogations, these so-called field interrogations. And the last incursions, which took place 3 days ago, started with an undercover Israeli force that killed three Palestinian youngsters between the age of 22 and 24. The Israeli army had prevented the medical teams from reaching them and released a statement before even the medical teams could reach the bodies, saying that they had eliminated three so-called terrorists and that an exchange of fire took place. Within less than half an hour, CCTV camera footage, which, by the way, prior to October 7th, the Israeli army would have gone into the house and confiscated the footage. This is a well-documented practice of taking away camera footage. But it seems the new rules of engagement allows not only for murdering youngsters, but also for neglecting even to destroy the evidence, because who cares? We can just call them terrorists and release pictures of guns supposedly confiscated in the area. Their claim actually was pretty specific, which is that an exchange of fire took place. And this is not uncommon in terms of fabrication. And this, I think, is on the media. The way that the media allows Israel to release fabricated evidence, don't check it, and release it as claims. Before I went on air, I closed the window so that you don't actually hear the army. Usually I'm filming from right this window as the jeeps are driving towards Nur Shams. From my location, I can tell that they're heading towards Nur Shams refugee camp right now. So I was talking about the media bias and how it allows the Israeli military to get away with this sort of merciless murder. There is another footage, by the way, from the other side, which shows the soldiers were basically waiting for the kids to try and run out from that door and shot them. So in the recent case, to go back to the issue of journalists, in the recent case of Hamza Dahdouh and Mustafa Abu Traya, you may have seen that 2 days after their murder, Israel released a statement as a series of tweets in three languages with the Arabic and Hebrew, including more garbage than the English version. That tweet included a document that was completely fabricated. It had the date and the day mixed up. The language is laughable and absurd. And to just give you a glimpse of, like, also the situation here, it would be actually difficult for me as a journalist to contact a lecturer at a local university and say, can you give me a statement about this being really a made-up story? They will straight away, when they see this document, they will see the fabrication and they will laugh it off. But they will not want to be publicly seen making statements that dismiss such fabrications. And this fabrication also claims is based on claims that they had found documents in Gaza during the invasion. But this fabricated document, even they only shared one, but these fabricated claims are about well-known figures, you know. So, and the media fails to check, the media not only fails to check, these people work for well-established organizations. For example, Hamza is one of the most skilled media drone operators in Gaza. Work is a commissioned work for AFP. Al Jazeera over the last 3 years has been providing materials for Al Jazeera, showing the level of destruction. And this is why he was targeted. And by sharing this statement, it shows the level of impunity, not only from international organizations such as the UN and human rights organizations, and so, but it also shows the level of complicity of the media, that Israel can release such fabrications, and it is within, you know, their knowledge that this person is actually an actual journalist and still carry these lies.
you know, it really is honestly sometimes amazing. And I guess, you know, because of social media this time around, especially those of us in the United States where the media is so biased, as you point out, are able to see, you know, without filter, without mediation, the actual Palestinian story. I mean, of course, you know, I wish none of this was happening in the sense of what we've seen in this genocide. But does it feel to you, at the very least, because of social media, that maybe more now than in past conflicts, the Palestinian voice is able to break through in a popular way without some of these gatekeepers, despite the fact that obviously they're still there and still continuing to report poorly?
I wish I could say yes, to be honest with you. I think, obviously, a lot of our supporters, many Palestinians live in a world where we are the media war completely and so on. I wish that was true. But you find in reality that even social media companies are censoring Palestinian voices. And in this reality where there is high level of interest and little room for speech for us Palestinians, wherever we are, you find the perfect scenario for a lot of grifters, accounts that don't really care about what happens to Palestinians, as long as on the short term they can make some sort of a gain, whether it's financial, whether it's clout, or whatever it may be. I think it's important to remind all the people who have been part of this struggle for a long time and have a more nuanced understanding of the situation, that we have a lot of new supporters that are coming in, and this puts a responsibility on us to reach out to them and provide information, protect them from falling victim to, you know, the wrong type of account. I'm not, I call myself an optimist. I see, obviously, the bright side of the exposure of Israel's genocidal campaign and its true face to a much wider layer in the global world. It's important, but if we can't turn this into effective action, this is just going to be noise. And as soon as there is a ceasefire, the people of Gaza will not find much needed support that they will continue to need, and Palestinians in general.
Well, we really appreciate you being willing to join us here and help shed some light on all of this. Anan Kousmar, a volunteer with the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate based in the occupied West Bank. Thanks for giving us some of your time here on the Freedom Side.
Thank you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Anan Kousmar talking on the on Breakthrough News about the atrocities being committed against Palestinian journalists in this war. Which is a definite war crime by the state of Israel. Now, I want to conclude here on Back in the USSR by playing the situation rep that Justin Podor of the Anti-Empire Project did on January 13th, because he has some decent commentary about the ICJ case as well, but he really outlines in a really thorough way, the situation in Yemen right now, which has grabbed the headlines and which has everybody concerned about a wider Middle East war right now. So he really breaks it down, and I want to get into that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is. I'm going to turn it over to Justin Podor's with the Anti-Empire Project's recent sit rep. Please stay tuned.
Welcome to the Gaza War sit rep, day 98. This is the night of January 12th. And as I promised yesterday, to do one after the Israeli defense at the International Court of Justice. So here I am. The Israeli defense at the International Court of Justice is not actually of that much interest. It was the same lies that we have been hearing the whole time. A lot of screaming Hamas, a lot of claiming that the court, the South Africans, everybody is biased against Israel because they won't let them commit this genocide. There's a logical contradictions, legal contradictions, moral failings, all too numerous to be listed. One contradiction that I haven't noticed too many people point out was that they said something like, if this is genocide, then you're cheapening the word genocide. Also, what happened to us on October 7th was a second Holocaust, and Hamas is the ones committing genocide. So, to defend Israel and what Israel's doing requires moral collapse and logical failures. And so it's no surprise that that's what the legal team brought to the table. It's also the defensive behavior of people, a state, an entity that is clearly used to not having to explain itself and does not ever, its representatives don't believe they should have to explain themselves. And the same goes for the Western defenders of it. They were just very dismissive. Blinken, Kirby, whatever, all of those American officials, Canadian officials today, the Prime Minister of Canada, the various ministers of Canada have gone on record dismissing South Africa's case. So again, I guess we should game it out. It's going to take these judges apparently weeks to figure out what it is that they should decide. Provisional measures, which means they can either order Israel to stop. Human rights organizations don't like to organize to order belligerents to stop. So we could see something like that. We could see something like the International Court of Justice behaving like Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch and saying, please conduct your genocide in a less dangerous way, or tone down the rhetoric or whatever. Maybe they'll just say, we understand you have a right to self-defense and please go and kill people, but not too much, not too bad. So I think those are the options they could find simply in favor of Israel, which would mean the court was corrupted and the outcome stitched up from the beginning. They could find basically that provisional measures mean Israel needs to stop, and effectively ordering Israel to effectively ordering a ceasefire coming from the court. Or they could order some inadequate thing, some splitting the difference to try to make it seem like the court is still relevant, like international law is still relevant, while not actually offering any meaningful constraint. I mean, not that, of course, Israel will always be free to ignore, but an inadequate finding like, please conduct your war more nicely would be perfect for Israel, because Israel could say, yes, of course, that's what we'll do. And thank you very much. And we'll do that. Or we've been doing that all along, which was also part of their defense. So I guess we'll see in a few weeks. The importance of the trial at the International Court of Justice was day one, was the South African lawyers and what they presented, the farcical nature of Israel's defense today, and in fact the ruling that the court makes, which is going to be ignored anyway, are less important than the fact that South Africa brought this suit, made this case in front of the world. I said yesterday, as a realpolitik, someone with a realpolitik understanding of the world, I can never get overexcited about what happens in courtrooms and international law, but it's not without importance and it's not without meaning. The other thing that's clear to me, especially now that I watched it, is, the alternative to finding for South Africa, the alternative that it's not really the International Court of Justice, it's more like, I would say, the US what the U.S. is facing here is a choice between letting the International Court of Justice make this decision that clearly follows the law and logic and morality, or just absolutely flaming the court once and for all. And that means the International Court of Justice is over. It's exposed as a corrupt and useless institution, which I suspect it is. But, you know, I guess I do think that more people, how to put it, more people, more of a mass recognition of the uselessness of international institutions is bad for the US. This is a bad thing. It's actually the imperialist countries that depend on these institutions far more, despite what they would have you believe. It's them that need everybody to follow the law and everybody to use these mechanisms to settle their disputes. And it's them that want all of these things to be channeled through international institutions under their control, as opposed to searching for and creating alternatives, which is what will have to happen if the International Court of Justice is found to be corrupt, which is what's at stake here. And then you'll see Global South nations just making bilateral decisions. You'll see aid programs rolled out on a bilateral basis, and you'll see bilateral dispute mechanisms through BRICS or Shanghai Cooperation or whatever other alternatives there are. And those will become the new forums for dispute resolution between countries as well. So it's not a small deal. I don't think it's the big deal that some are making of it, and I don't think that it's going to be where this is decided. So I guess with that, let's go back to our five other fronts. And of course, we have to start with Yemen. The Americans unilaterally bombed the airport in Sana'a again in Yemen. Yemen has presumably been fighting back. There have been some statements. There have been some, of course, very strong statements by Yemen, very strong songs that they've sung. You may have seen the demonstration in the capital of at least a million people yet again on Friday. And the song that they sing, the chant that they have, I might as well show it to you on Aldan Markey's Twitter, Aldan Markey, A-L-D-A-N-M-A-R-K-I, one of the best Twitter accounts to follow on anything related to Yemen. And the chant apparently goes, "We do not care, make it a world war, make it a grand world war. Our hearts long for rifles and battles. By God, living like this is forbidden to me." So not deterred. I think we can safely say not deterred. Now, people have pointed out that this is an extremely asymmetric situation, that Yemen does not have anything like the armament that NATO is bringing to bear in the Red Sea, and that's true. But what Yemen does have is it's not that different from, for example, the DPRK, otherwise known as North Korea. They are it's not that they can hit you with the same firepower that you can hit them with. It's just that you can't do very much to them because they have endured so much, and they have the ability to they have developed some form of deterrence. So the missiles and the drones that Ansarullah in Yemen has are analysts have pointed out that they're a few thousand dollars per drone, and they're when they're launched at a U.S. naval ship's anti-aircraft system or air defense, the air defense missiles that are shot, that are shooting them down, are millions of dollars. So Yemen has far less money than the US, but the US has a lot of places to spend that money and a lot of demand on those missiles that have to be everywhere in the world. The US has interests everywhere. Yemen has interests only in trying to stop the genocide in Gaza at the moment. That's their only interest, and their tool is what they are using right now in the Red Sea to try to stop shipping. They are so what happens when their multi-thousand-dollar drones exhaust the supply of multi-million dollar air defense missiles on these finite supplied, terrifying naval assets that the US has? Then they would be firing missiles and drones at unprotected ships. And so the mathematical equation that's happening here, the calculations that the US has to be making, I'm not sure. They don't look favorable to me. Maybe, as always, I'm missing something. So that's Yemen. So I guess one point, and we'll probably come back to this, is that the same way that asymmetric and guerrilla warfare is occurring in Gaza and has happened historically with Vietnam and many other examples, there's a kind of an asymmetric naval conflict happening in the Red Sea. And I didn't really know asymmetric naval conflicts existed, and I don't know of too many other precedents for this, but this is certainly one of them. Now we're witnessing yet another unprecedented occurrence. Maybe it's not unprecedented. I've been studying a little bit more about naval warfare recently, and usually it's one state against another. The great naval battles of history are between belligerents of, you know, comparable, at least status, right? I mean, of course, when you talk about World War One and the German Navy going up against the British Navy, the British Navy is much bigger and more powerful. The German ships are well equipped and technological, but the Royal Navy, the British Navy, is superior. So, of course, there's always asymmetries at sea, but the idea of like a guerrilla warfare happening at sea, you know, pirates, I don't think quite worked that way, although that's the way that the US war propaganda is trying to paint Ansarullah as pirates. But this goes way beyond pirates. This is much more like naval guerrilla warfare, naval asymmetric warfare. So we'll come back to this probably again and again. We have absolutely not seen, we're only seeing the beginning of this. We're not seeing the end of, we're nowhere near the end of this. The other key point that I think the US that's going to have to focus the minds of the US who want to conduct a war on Ansarullah in Yemen, is that Yemen has said that the Arab countries that allow the US to use their airspace as transit on their way to bombing Yemen will be treated as enemies as well, which means, you know, yesterday in my sit rep, I said that because Saudi Arabia is trying to calm things down and take a more neutral position, Saudi Arabia, which has been the principal bomber and attacker of Yemen using US weapons for 7 years, from 2015 to 2022, is trying to keep things calm and de-escalate things. But if I mentioned that means that Yemen doesn't have the ability to target these very valuable oil infrastructure targets that brought the war quickly to an end when Yemen started to do that in 2022. But if Saudi airspace is used, that could be back on the table. So we are, again, in a very uncertain situation on that front. Well, not just that front. So as far as Lebanon goes, we have more fighting, the continuing war of attrition on the Lebanon front. We have, I don't think there's, let me see if there's been any major, I don't think I've seen anything beyond, I don't think I've seen anything today about Hezbollah. I could be wrong. There are, on the other hand, but just to say about on the Palestine front, there have been a number of attacks in the West Bank, in Tulkarm. Tulkarm is one of the West Bank cities that has been completely surrounded by the so-called apartheid wall. There have been attacks in Jenin. So there's fighting in Jenin, there's fighting in Tulkarm. These are both important cities in the West Bank. And fighting in Gaza, as always. There was a report of another evacuation of Israeli soldiers from Gaza. Yes, casualties on the, yeah, they did announce casualties on the Lebanon front as well. So we have Gaza, Lebanon, and the West Bank, all active ground fighting. Iraq, there's an Iraqi resistance groups have claimed attacks, two further missile attacks on in northern Iraq, again near Erbil, I believe, targeting possible U.S. and Israeli intelligence assets. There have been rocket attacks from Gaza. I'm just scrolling to find the news about the Iraqi resistance attack. Let me see if I can find it. Having some trouble finding it. I believe it was two separate missile attacks in Iraq. And I have not seen anything on the Syria front. Yes, attacking. So the Iraqi resistance attacked a U.S. base in Syria with missiles. Gaza attacked. There were attacks from Gaza into Ashdod and a few other parts of the so-called Gaza envelope and beyond inside the borders of Israel. And so active rocket and missile fire from Iraq into Syria, attack, a war of attrition on the Lebanon front, fighting in Gaza, fighting in the West Bank, and the war ongoing in Yemen, virtually across the board. There's also, there was a video today from Al-Quds, Soraya Al-Quds, which is the armed wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And they sent a video maybe of a day or two ago, but of mortar attacks in Gaza. So I think that covers all the fronts, and there's absolutely no let up on any of them. There's escalation in the West Bank, and then there's this war in the Red Sea and the bombing of Yemen. So in future updates, there's a piece that I'm reading that I want to get back to you guys on when I've read enough of it. And it's, I think I've mentioned this dynamic before, but I'll just give you a preview. the dynamic is one where it goes to back to World War II. And it's a book called Why Did the Heavens Not Darken by Arno Meyer. And it's about the Holocaust, basically. And the fundamental argument of the book is that when the German army in World War II was losing, when they realized they weren't going to win after invading Russia, after invading the Soviet Union, the initial plan in 1941 was always to deport the Jewish population, which they hated and loathed and were racist against. But so the first few months were going very well for them, and so they were happy with this deportation plan. But as things started to go badly for them militarily was when they began to develop more and more of a Holocaust genocidal impulse towards civilian Jewish people. And that is a dynamic that I think needs to be studied and an analogy made between losing militarily and kind of taking it out on civilians or going more genocidal against civilians when you are losing militarily. So I'll come back with more notes from that. And I also want to go back over October 7th yet again. We have to go through that day very carefully and find out really exactly what happened from all the sources. We want to find out the best information on who, you know, how much the role that friendly fire played, especially on the scale of civilian casualties in the Gaza envelope. Okay, I'll stop there. That's day 98, and I'll see you in a few days. We'll probably do something for day 100, but next week, we'll get back into October 7th, and I'm sure there will be huge updates. The court is not going to roll for a while. You probably have heard that Germany has announced that based on literally, it's hard to parody these people, but they've announced that because they know so much about genocide, because they've committed it, they've decided that that Israel is not committing it. And they're going to intervene as a third party when the case reaches its merit stage. The other thing, one last thing about the case, that everybody seems to accept the merits stage of the case is going to take years. It shouldn't. It shouldn't take years. There's no logical reason why it should take years. And the notion of international justice just simply having to take years, the court having to take years to decide whether a genocide took place, That's not to the court's credit. It's not to the credit of these institutions at all. And, you know, that alone is a reason why such a court should not, you know, may not be taken as seriously as it pretends to be or you know, would like to be. Okay, I'll stop there and I'll see you again in a few days.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights throws me, in jails they all know me, frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor, they pull and leap on me, They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleets me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.